hope so, yeah. But yeah, it seems like that law is, it's conflicting with federal law. So, you know, federal law says if shelters are full, you know, homeless people can crash on public grounds. So, and there's a need for it as well. I mean, ideally, I guess the local council would just grant the land to these people, you know?
I think you're thinking Australia terms, not U.S. terms. This is a land of corporate yum-yums.
Yeah. Well, I kind of like it. I've been staying there a little bit, and I like the fact that there's a struggle going on, and it's kind of cool, you know? It gives people like a fighting spirit, you know? But I think, it seems like things are turning around, and it's been, the camp's been there a long time, but one way or another, maybe they just need to, I think they need to, you're right, they need to go to court, man. They need to go to, like, a federal court, basically, and have the local council laws overridden because they're ultra-virus.
Thank you.
No worries, yeah.
Well, we have with us here a notorious camp personality, Larry Templeton. We're talking to
Sadhana.
And Sadhana, we're leaning on borders here in the shade on Monday afternoon about 4:30 at the Camp Paradise support table. And you're a traveler who's halfway around the world from your normal roosting place.
Yes, it's Holland, yeah.
And you don't travel in the fanciest hotels. You're a low-income traveler.
Yes, I'm traveling very budget, low-budget hostels. So that's the lowest you can get.
And you've been here for a couple of days?
I'm here for a couple of days in Santa Cruz, yeah.
You've been here before?
No, never.
You've been around the world before?
Yes.
Really? So this is just an old hat to you?
This is just seeing what is Santa Cruz like, you know? They said that it's a nice town and friendly people, and so I'm here.
Now, how do you treat homeless people in Holland, or do you have any homeless people in Holland?
We have a lot.
So what do you do about that?
Well, if I can get across them, if I can have a reasonable talk, if they are not drunk or on drugs, because they are most of the time in Holland, you know, so... then I can have a talk in the parks when they are there. So I sit on a bank, or how do you call it?
Like a bench.
Bench. So sometimes they're sitting next to me, so we have a nice chat.
Now, what about the police? So the police, is it a crime to be homeless in Holland?
No.
Is it a crime to fall asleep on the on the road or on the street?
No. Holland is free. Holland is free country. Mm-hmm. You can smoke whatever you want. You can drink whatever you want. You can sleep wherever you want.
Now, what about shooting up heroin?
Huh?
Heroin? What about heroin?
Everyone is reasonable free to use whatever they want. They like you have your own responsibility. So if you want to have drugs, you take drugs. You know? So they believe that everyone has his own reasonable sense, and if they choose to do that, that's their reason.
What do you notice about Santa Cruz? Any particular impressions that strike you most sharply?
It's a relaxing town.
And you previously stayed in...
Huh?
Where did you last stay?
In Monterey.
And before that?
Before in Yosemite Park.
And before that?
In Yellowstone Park, in Salt Lake City. And before that, Yellowstone Park. And before that, Rocky Mountains in Canada. Mm-hmm. And
you've been kind of jumping across the country from one tourist mecca to another.
Yes.
Well, anything you want to say to the Free Radio Santa Cruz folks here?
Yes, I would like to say that I've been noticed also in the hostels, coming from a free country like Holland. I feel it much more freer than America.
And where do you notice that? How do you notice?
What I notice is that they like to give a lot of rules here, because we have to be in the hostel at 11 o'clock. We have to be out of the hostel at 10 o'clock. And so you have to stay at the street the whole day, homeless too. You know,
like the homeless in the shelters.
So this is ridiculous. I mean, they want to make rules, and it's not free.
Now, so is that similar to Germany, or is it different than Germany?
I don't know Germany. I have been once in Germany, but Holland and Germany, they have a kind of strange relationship. So Dutch people doesn't really enjoy to be in Germany.
I want to thank you, and if you have any more thoughts before I click this thing off, now's your chance.
Well, let everybody decide wherever they want to stay.
Fair enough.
Yeah, fair enough.
Thank you.
Or at least, if they haven't got a place to stay, don't arrest them for falling asleep where they must. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your sleepy host, Uncle Robert Norris here. Call-in number is 427-3772, and lines are open. So jump on the lines if you want to get in. We have now a conclusion of an interview with Anitra Freeman. Anitra Freeman is from Seattle, Washington, and was talking to us last time. Actually, we were playing last time a conversation we had at the NASNA conference with her, the North American Street Newspaper Association conference up in San Francisco, around their Seattle tent city and the laws in Seattle governing, or shall I say, oppressing homeless people. And we're going to continue and conclude that tape now. Seattle, as I said, is one of two cities that have ongoing de facto legal campgrounds. So they're not actually legal. They have to constantly be on the alert for police closure. They are always under a cloud. They're fighting in the court, so they're not really legal in the sense that you can go into your house and only have to worry about is if your neighbor is accused of using illegal drugs, in which case the police can rush in and do what they want, even in your own home. But even though these tent cities in Seattle and Portland are not legal, specifically legal, they have been continuing month after month up there, and they've been funded by the community and to some extent by some social service agencies, and they've been serving homeless people, and they've been managed and run by homeless people. And now we're going to hear Anitra Freeman of Seattle talking more about continuing her discussion of the Seattle situation.
1,000. I take it that advocates have tried to challenge the camping ordinance as unconstitutional in the Washington courts.
Yes.
What's happened?
Well, that we have two cases going on right now. One is that at one time last year, El Centro de la Raza, a Latino community center, invited Tent City to stay on their grounds from July 16th through January 15th. 6 months. Partway into that, the Department of Construction and Land Use started fining them $75 a day for violation of zoning regulations. El Centro applied for a permit, an official permit from the Department of Construction and Land Use, and DCLU suspended the fine while the permit process was going through. DCLU received over 300 letters from the public during the public submission process on the issue, and 8 of them were against it, against granting the permit, and all the rest were for it. DCLU interviewed the police, who all said that Tent City had no measurable impact on crime or in the neighborhood, and et cetera, et cetera. And DCLU made the decision to refuse the permit. We immediately appealed. It went through the internal DCLU process and was still denied, but now it's gone to King County Court. Mm-hmm. And we believe that in King County Court, the permit denial will be overturned. the permit. And so even though it's now, you know, long past you know, the time we were at El Centro, once that permit is recognized as valid, the fines will not be levied against El Centro, and there will be a precedent for saying that Tent City is legal. So that's one case in the courts. The second thing is in the courts was filed more recently, and that is an injunction against Seattle ticketing, citing, arresting, levying fines on, you know, in any way harassing any homeless person sleeping outside until there is enough housing and shelter for everyone. And that, so that's in the courts right now.
And is this prepared by attorneys that were hired by Share or Wheel, or where did they come from?
It's prepared by attorneys who have volunteered to work for Share and Wheel.
Any estimate how long such an injunction takes to prepare? We've been talking about a similar such injunction in Santa Cruz.
It took many months, and you know, we've been talking about it for years, and finally found attorneys who were experts in constitutional law who were willing to work on it, and that it took them I think 2 or 3 months to prepare it, and it's going to take probably, you know, maybe close to a year to ever get to court, and I don't know how long it'll take to get to court, but it's going to drag on for a while. It isn't something that, you know, usually you think of an injunction as something that gets heard immediately and levied immediately, and maybe some of them do, but this one's going to drag on.
Injunctions against the government. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Now, what about the cases of just an ordinary criminal case under, I don't know, whatever Seattle Municipal Code is used to penalize people for sleeping? Has such a case ever been taken forward on constitutional issues to the state and federal higher courts?
It hasn't formally, but it's never gotten that far. The funny thing is that, you know, the police regularly ticket people and harass people and move people on, and yet every time that anybody has actually been arrested and gone as far as court in Seattle, the case has always been dismissed.
Really?
Nobody has ever been convicted who was arrested for sleeping. You know, no homeless person has ever been convicted who's been arrested for sleeping outside, and it still doesn't stop the police from arresting them. In fact, during our 1998 Tent City, the case of one of the homeless men went all the way to court and was thrown, the judge threw it out with the statement that, you know, dismissed the charges with the statement, when the city, I will prosecute homeless people for sleeping outside when the city of Seattle provides enough shelter and housing for all of them.
Well, has anybody tried a civil lawsuit against the police department for harassment of the homeless, considering the decision of this judge, or perhaps, and if it's repeated, the decision of numerous judges? Maybe that's the nature of the injunction that's being tried, or maybe it's something different.
Well, the injunction is pretty much along those lines. You know, just stop, you know, stop doing it.
Something that Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco does regularly is it sues the police department in small claims court for confiscation of homeless property. Has anything like that been tried in Seattle?
No, not yet.
Is that something that can be done without lawyers? And it's just, you know, $15 in California. I don't know how much it is in Washington State. The other thing that's been tried in California is the necessity defense. I don't know if, I presume Washington has an equivalent of the California necessity defense, which it's a complicated defense to prove and requires six elements, but essentially it involves pleading guilty but saying there was a it was necessary to commit the crime to avoid a greater evil. And the value of this defense is not so much, I don't know whether sleeping is an infraction or a misdemeanor in Washington, but if it's a misdemeanor, it's useful to use this defense because it ties up the courts with jury trials, if the case ever gets to trial. But if the judges are always dismissing these cases, you have any stats on how many such cases have been dismissed in the last decade? Or
not that I could remember off the head of my head.
Well, hustle back. Give me the facts, woman.
You're tired.
You're looking even more tired. I think I'm making you tired here, Anitra. We're talking to Anitra Freeman of Seattle, Washington, a perennial homeless activist and writer. Anything you want to add before we both fall asleep here? Could be illegal later on tonight.
Yeah.
San Francisco has such a law.
Let's keep sleeping legal.
That's right. Safe and legal, man.
And that was me and Anitra Freeman talking a couple weeks ago at NASNA, North American Street Newspaper Association. You can get your street newspaper here by giving a call to 423-HUFF or checking out Carl Wilson or Becky Johnson, both of whom are distributors of Street Spirit. If you're a street person in the sense that you are homeless or nearly homeless, you can sell Street Spirit for $1 a copy. First 10 copies are free. The next 10 you got to pay a dime a piece for. Great story on Camp Paradise and other homeless issues.
On Free Radio.
Well, hello there, Robert.
Oh, it's that legalistic madman, Uncle Bob LaMonica.
Well, I had a quote here from Hamlet that I was going to refer a previous caller to. It's from Polonius. It's a line from Polonius. This above all, to thine own self be true.
Then it must follow as the night the day, when you canst not then be false to any man.
Yeah, I mean, Robert, you're such a Shakespearean. Most of your audience doesn't know that you studied and acted in Shakespeare in college.
Well, they'd better learn. Anyway, yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, in regards to the topic du jour of Camp Paradise, is it not a squad that wants to be grandfathered in?
Well, they've actually given some alternatives that they want to do. I think what they want to do is they want a legal place somewhere to be able to sleep that they can lease, rent, or be on. And they're not insisting that the property they're on that they be on in perpetuity, so I would have to say technically no. They're not trying to grandfather in their tent area, and I don't want to call them a squat because I don't like the way that's phrased, and I also think that it is kind of misleading. Squats usually have to do with buildings, and taking over buildings, in order to protest against landlords, or because the landlords, have let them fall into destitute and the buildings are abandoned. But
what would you call it then? What would you refer to it colloquially and legally?
I would say it is an encampment and a camp or tent city, or a tent village, if you will, that has arisen for mutual protection by homeless people on a public property.
An illegal public property encampment.
Well, you know, Jews were illegal in Germany. I couldn't care less whether it's legal or illegal. So what? You know, I mean, my question is it accord with basic human rights under the UN Charter, under the U.S. Constitution, under the California Constitution, and under any sensible, shall we say, estimation of what's going on?
Well, now, rights exist ideologically, and they exist legally. Now, ideologically, you may well be correct, and
Thank
I agree
you.
With you. People have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Definitely. Inalienable rights.
They have a right. Now, idealistically, they have that right. Legally, they have no rights that are not spelled out in law.
Well, no, I don't know if that's actually true, Bob. I mean, you know, there's a thing called substantive due process. A lot of laws are actually set up to restrict people's rights rather than to expand them.
Well, what is it? The Tenth Amendment, I think it says that
reserves all rights to people.
Okay,
that's
pretty on paper kind of stuff. But the reality is that when a situation is presented to the law, then a determination is made whether this is in or out.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot smoke pot legally, unless you have a card that says that you're you have a problem and you need medical marijuana. That's kind of a little creeping gray area thing that's happening. But just to use that as a technicality,
mm-hmm.
all right? And I was going to say that the problem with a low-cost legal campground are things like health codes, liability, and that's on top of the NIMBY issues.
Well, now, let's address each of those issues
okay,
in turn.
Please. Yeah.
Because actually, I think that I didn't see the show Voices from the Village with Kennedy and Premack. I think we're expressing the same concerns on the Voices from the Village on Thursday. I hear. Again, I didn't see it. But, you know, you can have liability waivers. That's one. And two, regarding health and safety, you know, the question is, are the basic health and safety requirements being met? That is to do with sanitation, water, you know, and also not, of course, polluting the environment, which is another, you know, a significant consideration you didn't mention but has been mentioned by others. And there are actually, I was at the Green Party meeting yesterday, the Green Party Assembly, where Khalil, he's an official for the Monterey Environmental, some state agency that looks after water quality, I think, down there. He has been doing a survey of the kind of, you know, environmental impact of the tent city on, city's a little strong, the encampment on the surrounding area. And he's come up with a report which I haven't really mastered or read through, but the verbal report he gave to the Green Party I think indicated that they had met the requirements, in fact, more so than the previous, the city, which had allowed the environment to go to hell, and of course the beach boardwalk to seize and despoil, you know, the tidelands, and Saul's tannery to pollute the river. So it's really, it's important, I think, for us to view this whole thing in context. But even in context, or even if you want to be an absolutist and talk about, you know...
One thing must be said in regards to Salt's Tannery and the boardwalk.
Yeah.
They contributed to the tax base.
Right. Well, I think it's also true that those who are working citizens or working people, even if they're poor, they have to pay taxes too, and they do. It gets taken out of their, you know, what they spend in town. And also, it's not just the tax base. Scott Kennedy used this argument to say we should give away, you know, the Third Street and all that area to the beach boardwalk. By claiming that somehow this is going to give us more money for social services by broadening the tax base. I mean, you know, that's... to me, the argument has to do with a lot of other things, such as what kinds of impacts, generally, does a community of people have on the broader community? And apparently, the neighbors at Camp Paradise really like what the people at Camp Paradise have done. It's hard to find people who don't. Oh, except, of course, for the occasional caller to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
I wonder how much of the neighborhood positive concern is in regards to their property values possibly increasing because the drug and crime and litter problems have decreased.
But isn't that also a social value for the broader community? I mean, it may be true that that may give, you know, increase the property values, but it also increases its accessibility by the community. It increases the use that the rest of us can make of the area. It also has a sort of an intangible moral value that people can have a place to lift themselves up, that they are able to, you know, to get into a situation where they can care for themselves and help each other. I mean, this has a kind of a moral force that, you know, we don't talk about in, you know, 2001 that much among leftists or liberals, whoever we are. I don't know what we call ourselves, or you and I would call ourselves, libertarians. I don't know.
Well,
pariahs, you name it.
I think maybe if you and I have something in common, it would be activists in our perspective.
Certainly.
I mean, for example, Robert, I favor a low-income campground
mm-hmm.
on city property, by the way. I do not favor endless task forces and polls.
Excellent. I mean,
I think that we are so far past the time when the rhetoric and the blowhardism is useful at all that let's drop it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But what the fact is that most people who get into power are more interested in keeping that power than they are in any principle.
No question.
Okay, and they will find ways to look you in the eye and lie and spin you out, and Santa Cruz is renowned for polls and task forces
mm-hmm.
while taking this image of being progressive and hip. And in some ways it is. In some ways it is a tolerant little community, and it's fascinating, and it's charm and its cosmopolitan nature.
But getting back though to what you're saying, I don't think that the Camp Paradise people would have any trouble saying we if that low-income campground gets set up, we'll move to it right away.
I have no doubts, but I will. And in fact, I will be utterly shocked.
Right.
If anyone in any position of authority that they would take a risk leadership role and advocate for as bold a step.
Well, it's
as
not,
the city of Santa Cruz sponsoring a low-income camp.
Well, see, I don't think it's that bold a step now, because I think Camp Paradise is, it tends, if you look at the letters in the city council offices, and I was there 2 days ago, you know, it's 9-1 in favor of Camp Paradise. A week ago or 2 weeks ago it was 10-1, but I mean, that's just because not a lot of letters weren't coming in. I think it's now becoming, and you can see by Kennedy jumping on the bandwagon, as I understand he did, which kind of nauseates me somewhat, but I suppose it's always good to get people on your side, provided they don't lead you over the cliff, which I'm afraid Kennedy will do. But, you know, when Kennedy starts talking about using a nonprofit to run a low-income campground somewhere, then you can tell, you know, his nose is to the wind and he smells, you know, an issue that can be used. Or alternately, and let's give him a little credit, because there have been times when I think, rarely, but occasionally, like in the drummer's business in 1996 when he moved to derail the Rotkin regulations against drumming downtown and set up a mediation process. There are times when Kennedy says he does remember his origins. He originated long ago as a person who was concerned about the civil rights of poor people and then abandoned it in 1991, and pretty much has abandoned it ever since. But, you know, I think that, you know, it's now a popular issue. Camp Paradise is hard to criticize. Even the Sentinel is backing off, you know.
Let's see it. I look forward to seeing the specific plans and the in position authorities taking a leadership position on a difficult issue.
Oh, they won't take a leadership position. They'll follow, as you've pointed out. They always do. But it's becoming such common currency that I think that they will try to use it for their own purposes, as they always do.
The time might be ripe. I don't know whatever happened to the Poconepa golf course. Is that still in the works? The clubhouse?
The clubhouse, yeah. The $1 million clubhouse.
Okay, so that might, these things quite often come back to property values, property rights.
Right.
Poor people who tend to be disenfranchised and disorganized, is the general rule, except to get them out of the way, and when it becomes a scandal, don't get much.
Mm-hmm.
And they get less now than they did 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
30 years ago, it's astounding the amounts of money that were being thrown around to redistribute wealth. And now when you even mention that phrase, redistribute wealth, you're some kind of a commie.
Or rent control.
When you talk about rent control, is what Donna Dice said it once on your show. It's like saying abortion.
Right.
Can't even talk about it without people getting uptight and calling you a commie.
Any updates on rent control? Sorry.
It reminds me of in the 60s, there was this novelty toy called Bag Full of Laughs, and you could press a button and it would laugh, you know, ha 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 ha. That's where rent control is at, Robert. It is everything else under the sun will be discussed, other than limiting the ability of private property owners to charge what the market will bear and gouge and make exorbitant lifestyles off of those that don't own property.
Well, you remember what they're doing in Zimbabwe. They're just taking over the land. I suppose you would call them squatters. I mean, you know, that they're taking over the farmhouses. They're tired of waiting for the, I guess the government's cynical there too and playing games. Anyway, I got another call that I have to take.
Well, I hope you take it, and good to talk to you, Robert. And it's good that you're there.
Hey, thank you, Bob.
You bet, absolutely.
All
bye.
Right.
And I do mean that. I do have another call to take, even though there's only one line coming into the studio, because it was a call during the Anitra Freeman interview, and that was from Michael Tomasi. And Michael, if you're out there, give me a call. Michael apparently was dumped in Dominican recently and lied to by the police in an illustrative incident, and I'm hoping that he'll call in and talk about it. He called in during the Anitra Freeman interview. What he told me, in case he doesn't make it to the phone or he's tried already and found the line busy, is that he was parked in his van in front of his trailer in front of the police station, and Officer Seeley came and asked him to get out, said he wanted to talk to him, and he said, no, you're going to arrest me if I get out. And Seeley reassured him and reassured him and promised, and he got out. And, of course, he was immediately seized with apparently Police Chief Belcher on the steps watching and three or four cops present and dragged off to Dominican. And at that point, I missed the rest of the story, and I'm hoping that Michael Tomasi, who is a regular, if a brutally candid speaker at city council meetings, I hope he calls back. He's a man who has demanded that I will salute the American flag or stand for the Pledge of Allegiance or whatever, one of the two. In fact, this may be him now, and I want to get his account of what's going on. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Robert.
What's happening?
Not much. Should I tell the story?
Please do, and give it, and do
okay.
It. Take your time.
I want Bob LaMonica to call back while I'm back in my bus here, or my motorhome, and tell me about it. Okay. First of all, the Santa Cruz Police Department, when I went to court for you, stole my car. Second of all, Friday I went to go down to 7-Eleven to buy me some coffee. My motorhome overheated, so I stopped in front of the police department, made me a cup of coffee. Your homeless task force man, Mr. Seeley, came out to my motorhome, and he says, "Mike, I got the papers for us towing your car away. Would you please come out and get it?" I sat there for about 5 minutes and told him that if I went outside, he'd arrest me. Now, finally...
Before you go any further, Mike, were you doing anything illegal inside the van? I mean, were you...
I was drinking coffee.
Drinking coffee? That's pretty serious.
Drinking coffee, and I did nothing to anybody, said nothing, gave nobody the finger, and I fucking just sat there and threw a couple pennies in the fucking wishing well. I did nothing illegal. I've done nothing illegal. You're fucking sleepy. It's not illegal. It's very necessary, like I said a million times. If you don't sleep, you become mental.
Mm-hmm. I hear you.
And if you keep using absolute rule of the people, you create hatred, not rehabilitation.
Yep.
So I sat there, and I finally went outside, got attacked by the police, handcuffed, had bruises all over my arms, my hands.
How many police officers?
Oh, I don't know, about three.
Uh-huh.
Plus the chief of police up there looking like a cockroach. Now, on September the 12th of 1999, Mr. Norris, I went before the police review board, didn't I? You were there.
Mm-hmm.
You were right there. And those guys were calling these people pigs. Or I told them that pigs have a warm heart, and they have blood flowing through their veins, and they nurture their children. Police officers are not pigs. They're cockroaches. The motherfuckers, so you have to live with the son of a bitches because you can't do nothing about it because they know how to survive. They have the power.
Well, okay. What happened to you after they put you in handcuffs?
Okay, they put me in handcuffs and they took me down to the Dominican Hospital. Yeah. On my way to the Dominican Hospital, I told Mr. Seeley, I said, "Mr. Seeley, my dog is old. My dog will die in there. Please, don't take my dog to the dog pound. I'm not cleaned up yet. A few minutes." Mr. Seeley took my dog to the dog pound. My dog is laying in my motorhome full of fleas. And let me tell you, man, it took me a long time to get all the messes off my dog. Well, I'm telling you, I'm pretty pissed off because he didn't break no laws. Now, I'll tell you another thing. When I got down there, the lady...
When you got down to Dominican?
When I got to Dominican Hospital,
right.
The lady came out to talk to me. She says, "Mike, tell me about spelling dog backwards." And when I started telling her about the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, I got to, "For which it stands, one nation under God," a prayer came to my mind. I can't even remember even ever knowing this prayer in my life. You know, one was, "Lord, I am not worthy to come under your roof. Speak but the words and my soul will be healed." At that moment, it started thundering and lightning. At that moment, my dog says, "Mike, you must fight for your rights, and then you must fight against hatred of all of mankind." Well, let me tell you something, mister. It not only rained, it not only thundered and lightning, but the rain came out dirty. Because this fucking government is dirty. These people, our mayor is a suck-ass bitch, and Mr. to belt you down there is a blowhard.
Let me ask you, Michael, how long were you held at Dominican?
I was held for 5 minutes. I was there for about an hour and a half because they took all my money and they brought it down to the safe. And I'll tell you another thing. I asked the fucking asshole, Mr. Seeley, to lock my motorhome. He didn't lock my motorhome. And, you know, the only thing that got stolen out of my motorhome was my marijuana. So let me tell you something, mister. These fucking cops are the greedy hand. The DEA are the drug dealers, and our government oppressing us, putting us in fucking jail, and taking up our time because of their fucking little humble fucking, they're the best and they're better than us. And I told everybody that nobody is better than anybody. You're not better than anybody. And as far as Jesus goes, humanity is Jesus. The soul of man is Jesus. Everybody's fucking Jesus. Got that?
Got that.
And I'll tell you another thing. Man, you better say the pledge of allegiance to the flag before this fucking radio station is over. And I love you, Robert, and I fucking mean it, and I am not crazy, but if you don't, I'm going to fucking tear fucking bit of hair out of your fucking face and you can think of. I'll leave you a long gray hair for you.
Michael, I appreciate your call, and are you gonna, what do you think of, what do you think of an idea of a 10th city at City Hall?
I think you should have a 10th city in every person's front yard.
Was quite intelligible. I want to thank you, Michael, for giving us your account of what happened. Officer Seeley is, in fact, the officer hired, I guess, independently of the Homeless Issues Task Force report, but they did recommend that if any officer hired would be given specific training by homeless people, which, along with all the other resolutions, Mayor Sugar and then Vice Mayor Fitzmaurice refused to meaningfully discuss, much less implement. So, it's interesting to hear the claims that sounds like Officer Seeley, if Michael Tomasi is correct, was negligent in not locking the van, lied to him initially about whether he would be arrested or not, and then frivolously took him down to Dominican, where he was shortly thereafter released. It seems like maybe they were punishing him for parking his van, which apparently was done because he ran out of gas or had some mechanical problem in front of the police station. I find that kind of ominous, really. Michael and I don't see eye to eye on all things, and Michael has strong passions that I don't share on different occasions, but we do share some basic concerns about basic rights for homeless people, which I think he puts quite eloquently. He is himself a homeless person who lives in his vehicle. Free Radio Santa Cruz is what you're tuned to. It's 96.3 FM. We're going into the last 20 minutes of Bathroom Spears Broadsides, and we have a call.
You're on the air.
Are you going to read the Pledge of Allegiance?
I am going to read, instead of the Pledge of Allegiance, a...
Hand on your heart. God damn it, I'm going to fucking punch you in the fucking face, you fucking blonde-haired hippie!
We certainly do have some passionate callers calling in here to Free Radio, some of whom, by the way, I recognize in spite of their artful disguising of their voices, so don't try to fool an old hand here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm going to read the Pledge of Human Rights right now, which is, I think, very interesting. It's a report from Miami, Florida, about the changes in how homeless people are treated and how police have to treat homeless people based on the Pottinger decision. I'm going to start reading this. This is written in 1998, got it off the website from the National Coalition for the Homeless. The treatment of homeless people in Miami has greatly improved as a result of Pottinger versus Miami lawsuit and settlement. Recently, there have not been any sweeps or crackdowns on homeless people. Today, laws are not aggressively enforced against homeless people in Miami, according to Arthur Rosenberg, an attorney involved in the Pottinger case. Cities across the nation have closely monitored the Pottinger case. Lynn Summers, director of the Community Partnership for the Homeless and a former federal prosecutor, said many other cities have expressed an interest in the agreement and program. Advocates say that the settlement of this landmark Miami lawsuit could lead to a better treatment of the homeless across the United States. Now there is a policy which takes into account the rights and needs of the homeless person. A homeless person has a right to a bed and transportation to that bed, said Summers. Arthur Rosenberg said that the Pottinger case has had real significant and positive impact on homeless people, and the powers to be and the police see the need to participate for the very first time. That's the powers that be, I guess. These local officials sometimes even mention the Pottinger decision as a reason to do more. When the lawsuit was pending, the Pottinger case was very controversial, and it polarized the community. Now the Pottinger decision has become accepted as fact, and it is now very mainstream to say you support it. Around the state, communities are adopting policies and programs so that there is no Pottinger-like lawsuit. And this is very true. I know I'm interrupting this reading of the Miami report by noting that Fort Lauderdale actually instituted a tent city by the city in order to guard against a Pottinger-type lawsuit down there, which was threatened, which in essence said you cannot arrest people for sleeping or enforce laws like park closings unless you have a legal place for them to go. And so the city had to set up a tent city, and Fort Lauderdale did that even without a lawsuit being initiated because of the successful Pottinger lawsuit one county over in Dade County, Miami. A lawsuit in Santa Ana, California, used the necessity defense, that's the ICORN decision, that Rosenberg cites as one example of the impact of Pottinger. The court said that this defense is a valid one, but Rosenberg reports that Miami is complying with the settlement agreement, that there is heightened respect for the homeless. Local officials are aware that they can be pulled back into court at any time. So respect flows out of the power of a court order. Rosenberg has talked to a lot of homeless people through the compensation claims process, and the homeless people say there are not any major problems. A class of homeless plaintiffs challenged Miami's policy of arresting homeless people for conduct such as sleeping, eating, and congregating in public, and of confiscating and destroying their belongings. I'm going to read more of this decision in just a moment after taking this call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, this is John Tilghman in Santa Cruz Coalition Primo Mia.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to remind people that our Santa Cruz Coalition to Primo Mia is meeting this afternoon at 5 p.m. at Loud Nelson Park. We're going to be organizing for the demonstration this coming Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. on August 17th. We'll be followed by a vigil at the town clock. It's Friday, August 17th at the town clock. We'll be marching down Pacific Avenue starting at 7. Come back by 8, and then we'll have a vigil at the town clock, 8 to 9 p.m. There's also going to be a demonstration in San Francisco, August 18th, from 12 to 2 p.m., Powell and Market Street, San Francisco. That's Saturday, August 18th. And the carpools will assemble at the town clock in downtown Santa Cruz starting about 9:30 and leave probably by 10 o'clock a.m. or so. And if you need more information, you can call 425-4467. And basically the update on Mumia is that he's going to appear in state court in Pennsylvania on August 17th. And they're going to have a couple things going on. One is that they need to establish that the attorneys can do business in the state of Pennsylvania representing Mumia. And the other thing is they want to introduce new evidence such as the Arnold Beverly affidavit, where Arnold Beverly claims to be the person who actually shot Officer Faulkner. And there's one additional message I wanted to make sure that George checks her messages at Free Radio before she goes on here with Jeff Mackler this afternoon, because I had an important question I wanted to ask Jeff Mackler, but I'm not aware that I'll be able to call in, so I was wondering if George could ask that question for me when she's on, well, when she has Jeff on the line. So that's that.
Okay. Well, there may be some listeners who will be listening to that show who may be able to let her know about that.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I don't know if Jeff's going to be in the studio or calling in. I'm not sure about that part.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I think that covers it. I got a press conference in San Francisco on Friday. Friday, August 17th from 12 noon to 1 p.m. The State Building at Van Ness and McAllister in San Francisco. You can go to that too on Friday.
Okay.
And that's about it, basically.
Hey, thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and it's coming up again in courts in Philadelphia, and people are mobilizing to try to get some justice there. Always a difficult matter. Again, talking again about the Miami decision and the settlement there, now binding on the police department. In 1992, Judge Clyde Atkins issued a mandate for no-arrest safe zones that inspired Miami civic leaders to establish a nationally recognized system to lift the homeless out of a vicious cycle of arrests and aimlessness. At trial, the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida found that some 6,000 people in Miami were homeless, that there were fewer than 700 shelter spaces, and the plaintiffs were homeless involuntarily. The court found that the criminalization of essential acts performed in public when there was no alternative violated the plaintiff's right to travel and due process under the 14th Amendment and the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment under the 8th Amendment. In addition, the court found that the city's actions violated plaintiff's rights under the 4th Amendment. On appeal, the court ordered the city... purpose of clarifying the injunction and considering whether it should be modified since the safe zones were not operating as the district court envisioned. On remand, the district court modified its injunction, enjoining the city from arresting homeless persons until the city established two safe zones. In February 1996, the 11th Circuit referred the case for mediation. The parties negotiated a settlement approved October 1, 1998, during which the court mediated mediation during the court-ordered mediation process. The city agreed to implement various forms of training for its law enforcement officers for the purpose of sensitizing them to the unique struggle and circumstance of homeless persons and to ensure that their legal rights shall be fully respected. The city adopted a policy to protect the constitutional rights of homeless persons and to prevent arrest and harassment of those persons and the destruction of property in violation of those rights. All contrary conduct shall stop immediately. Additionally, the city instituted the law enforcement protocol to help protect the rights of homeless people who have encounters with police officers. And here is the key. This is the law enforcement protocol of the Pottinger decision. 1. Homeless persons not engaging in any criminal conduct. Miami police shall not arrest or detain such persons. A police officer or city social worker may approach these homeless persons and advise them of available shelter services or assistance. 2. Homeless persons reasonably believed to be mentally ill. When a homeless person meets the criteria for the involuntary examination under Florida law, the Baker Act, because he or she is a danger to himself, herself, or others, a police officer may take the homeless person to a receiving facility for involuntary examination. 3. Homeless persons observed violating a life-sustaining conduct misdemeanor. This is a key provision here. If a police officer observes a person who, because of his or her homelessness, commits one of the following misdemeanors: A. Being in a park after curfew hours. B. Public nudity, as is necessary to carry on the daily necessities of life. C. Fires in parks. D. Obstructing passage on sidewalks. E. Living or sleeping in a vehicle. F. Loitering in a restroom. G. Littering. H. Camping in parks. L. Use of facilities, like sleeping on a park bench, other than for the intended purpose. J. Building a temporary structure in a park. Or K. Trespass on or in public property, other than a structure or conveyance. All of these things, if a cop sees a homeless person doing any of these things, then the police officer, before arresting the homeless person, must offer the homeless person the option of going to an available shelter in the city of Miami or within 1 mile of it as an alternative to arrest. The police officer must know that a bed is available. The shelter used must treat the person with dignity and respect and cannot impose any religious requirements or any involuntary substance abuse or mental health treatment. If the homeless person accepts the offer of assistance, no arrest shall take place, and arrangements shall be made to transport the homeless person to the shelter. If the homeless person refuses to go, he or she may be arrested. If there is no shelter available, the police officer may not have any contact with the homeless person. Unless there is no available shelter, a police officer may always warn the homeless person to stop the unlawful conduct. 4. A police officer may arrest a homeless person observed violating a non-life-sustaining conduct misdemeanor or a felony without regard to the availability of a shelter. 6. The City of Miami shall follow its own procedures for taking custody of personal property. In no event will any city official or worker destroy any personal property known to belong to a homeless person of readily recognizable as property of a homeless person, except property which is contaminated or otherwise poses a health hazard. The city, however, is not responsible for taking custody of mattresses. 6. Record generation, maintenance, access. The city shall generate records of all arrests and detentions of homeless persons, as well as any encounters with homeless persons as described in the protocol, and maintain these records. 7. An advisory committee was set up to monitor all police contacts with homeless people. This will be made up of one person selected by the ACLU, one person selected by the city, and a third person selected by the other two committee members. The committee, which shall remain in existence for 3 years and renewable for one three-year period, shall monitor all police contacts with homeless persons, monitor police training, review records generated by the City of Miami relative to the settlement agreement, and receive and investigate complaints by homeless persons who claim to have been harmed by the city's non-compliance with settlement agreement. 8. Compensation. The city shall also agree to set up a compensation fund of $600,000 to compensate aggrieved members of the community. Compensation will be $1,500 per person, attorney fees $900,000. Total settlement amount $1.5 million. Rosenberg reports that as of September 15, 1999, 200 homeless people are likely to collect a total of $300,000. If the full $600,000 is not paid out in compensation, the rest will be used as a start-off fund to be available to any homeless person or family in Miami to help achieve permanent housing. That's from the Miami Herald, September 30, 1998. Now, that's what we need in Santa Cruz, folks. We need a lawsuit that requires not just the abolition of the sleeping ban and the blanket ban, not just the changes in the camping ordinance, but that will hold police officers to a protocol that means they will not approach a homeless person who is in a park after curfew hours, who is naked, who has got a fire in a park, who is obstructing a passage on a sidewalk, who's living or sleeping in a vehicle, who's littering, who's loitering in a restroom, who's camping in a park, who's building a temporary structure in a park, who is trespassing on public property, unless there is a shelter bed available. That's the bottom line, folks. That's what Just should be fighting for. That's what I'm going to suggest we fight for at our next meeting. Come down to Camp Paradise if you want to be a member of Friends of Camp Paradise or want to find out what's going on. They're having a meeting there at 2. Just will be having a meeting on Wednesday, probably sooner, actually. It's Huff that meets on Wednesday, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Just join us, sleep tonight, probably be meeting sooner. If you want more information, call 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And that's almost it for Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. We have a Tai Chi expert in the studio who is beginning to practice his new Protect the Homeless from Police Aggression stuff, which I...
Huff and puff!
Yeah, and he's...
Blow the camping ban away.
He's going to give it all a blow job. So hang on, we got an incoming call here.
Bob. Hi, you're on free radio. Mike.
Bob!
Yes?
Get Mike, Bob!
Yes.
It sounds like that there's some kind of drinking going on. I'm afraid that...
Alcoholics. Go to AA. Something.
Now, it sounds like we may have a problem in the studio. What are you drinking there, Bob?
Nothing.
He's, right.
Soy milk,
I see. Okay, well, Bathrobe Spears Broadsides will be returning, for those of you who like more of this stuff, on Thursday from 6 to 8 in the evenings. And if you want to get together and find out even more, come on down and, as I said, Camp Paradise at 2.
There is a meeting of the Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board tomorrow at 5:30. They meet once a month. And they will be, they have released the police chief's report. I was going to talk about it, but I ran out of time. The police chief's report on the May 1999 events, where there were actually four charges that were upheld by the independent investigator against the Santa Cruz Police Department, specifically charges of excessive force against Officer, oh, where has he gone, David LaFavor. And, of course, when you look at the police chief's analysis of all this, and that's what counts, folks, because the police chief does the discipline, the police chief upheld none of the excessive force. And he didn't even give them a spanking, man.
Hey, LaFavor was on America's Scariest Video, Cop Videos, last week, by the way.
That is true. I understand, actually, a week ago, the Steve Argue defense of Juliana and her daughter, or was it her son? I'm not sure. I guess it was her daughter, was played on the police video where Steve punched Officer LaFavor as he twisted this woman's arm, and she was in danger of dropping her child. And of course, Steve served time for that. So, as I said, you want to go to the police review board meeting and tell them that it's time for them all to resign and start a new organization where there's some real power, do it. That's 5:30 on Sunday, on a Monday, tomorrow. Or if you want to come out to the campground and start organizing a cop watch, like old Bob here used to do, Cop Watch Bob, we used to call him in the old days. That was before his skid mark. Where do you ever get that name from, man? Come on, give it a skid mark. I mean, come on. What is it, some sort of cool thing?
Okay,
I suppose.
Wrap it up.
All right, so now I'm getting told I have to leave the studio. I'm always get this kind of treatment toward the end of my show. You know, I don't appreciate it. I want you to know that. All right, so I'm leaving. Oh, wait, there's a quick phone call.
Hi, you're on free radio.
I want to talk to Bob.
Bob is here.
Hello. Hello. You're not there. Over and out. Stay tuned. 96.3.
I met Steve, many months ago. And probably one of the first times you had your sign out.
Yeah, that's how I met you. You wanted to take a picture of my sign.
And actually, I took a picture of you with the sign. We were organizing some event in March or April around the sleeping ban at the town clock with Steve Argue, and you were standing there with your sign quietly. And I was sort of saying, why aren't you making more noise? Why aren't you saying things?
I was sitting with my legs folded,
right,
and I was just holding the sign, kind of gazing off, and I look up and there you were standing there, a big guy with a beard, and I looked up at you and I was going, what's this guy want? And he goes, hey man,
I want you to demand your rights is what I want.
No, you were all happy and you said, hey man, do you mind if I take a picture of your sign? I go, sure, go ahead. And I just stood there and you snapped a shot and next thing I know, you're my friend.
Well, let's not get too intimate here, but in any case, I'm glad you've done this. You put in many hours of preparation for this trial and for the previous trial. And unfortunately, because you're homeless, you don't have the information that you used in the first trial. But hopefully this work you've done for the second trial can be used by other people who will no doubt find themselves, hopefully not, but may well find themselves harassed by police officers on Pacific Avenue, whose apparently intent is to clear away the undesirables there.
The reason why I don't have the paperwork from the first trial is because I was going to grill... what was his name?
Officer Perry.
Officer Perry. I was going to grill him with some pretty bad questions, and I didn't want any other cops in case I ever got stopped and frisked, they'd find those questions.
Paranoia is a frequent attribute of homeless folks on the streets, and we're going to forgive him on this one occasion without calling the mental health authorities. Go ahead.
What was the question again?
There was no question, actually. It was just a gratuitous, nasty comment, which you should kick me under the table for.
Okay.
Ouch! Stop that. All right. Anything you want to say before we leave this? I see your mouth is full, so it's an appropriate moment to ask you that question.
This food is good, thanks to Stephen Elliott.
So he's paying you off. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah.
It's actually a victory dinner.
Say, thank you guys very much. I really appreciate you guys standing up and helping.
And this is important, folks, because witnesses did come to this trial, because Steve took the trouble to go to the city attorney's office to demand this case be dropped. The city attorney actually called you back last night and threatened that this case would be a misdemeanor and refused to drop it, right?
Yeah, but he said it wasn't his fault. It was the police that were going to push it.
It's not his fault. Where have I heard this before? Thank you, John Barisoni, and thank you, Steve Elliott.
No, thank you. Thank anybody that's helped me along the streets. I really appreciate it. And one of these days, I'll be in better places, and I'll drop quarters in other people's cans and plates. And
that's
stuff.
What I do. I like to give some extra change to homeless people. It's fun.
And there you have it, folks. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to say, John, thank you for being there in both of my cases. I really appreciate it.
Glad to be there, man. Anytime you need me, I'll be there.
And that willingness of folks to testify on behalf of each other on the streets can deter police misconduct. And I think you're going to find less police harassment.
Yeah, I think if people are keeping an eye out for each other and they see what the cops are doing to each other and to us, then they know there will be witnesses around watching them.
Get that disabled sign back out there, buddy.
I don't think I'm going to do that again. I don't want to tempt fate.
But no more. I was going to leave anyway. That's what I understand. So take the full half hour, okay? Yeah. Since you've prepared for that. Yeah. And we'll arrange things around it. So.
Okay. Now, in the past, I've objected to preaching to choir, and we're going to be doing that this time, but this preaching is supposed to get you fired up, because this is an issue that Santa Cruz can do something about, and the Green Party can do something about. Now, we have some people coming down from Camp Paradise. They aren't here yet, and things get very busy and maybe sometimes askew up there. So when they come in, we will put them on. Before that, we have some... we have people to talk about Camp Paradise, and we have some stuff we'd like the Green Party to consent on. And some of that has been written down, so I'd like to have that passed around so people can chance to look at it. So we're going to start off with not the people who are going to describe all of Camp Paradise, but just certain aspects of it. Khalil? Would you like to go first?
Yes.
Okay. Introduce yourself and your involvement.
Yeah. My name is Khalil Abu Saba. I live here in Santa Cruz. I've lived here since 1990. I got my master's in marine science at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and then I got my PhD in chemistry up there. And in 1998, I started working for the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board, which is where I work now. I enforce the state water code over in San Francisco Bay. Over on this side of the hill, I'm just a citizen, but I got really interested in Camp Paradise because, you know, over the summer, as, you know, reading the news and listening to Sarah, my wife, kind of fill me in on some of the details, what I began to understand was that we had, you know, out of the 2,000 or 3,000 homeless people living in Santa Cruz County, we had 20 or 30 that had actually banded together and, you know, for their own protection, formed an organized campground, and at the same time had done something really positive for the community. They'd actually, you know, managed to remove 24 tons of garbage, and, you know, pull up some hypodermic needles and get rid of those, and actually drive away some drug trafficking that was going on in the neighborhood and win the support of their neighbors. And that was really interesting, particularly in the light of the fact that, you know, it was becoming clear that city staff were, you know, wanting, you know, aware of this and yet at the same time uncomfortable with acknowledging or allowing somebody to sleep outdoors because it is against the municipal code, it kind of put them in a really interesting tension. And so they began to raise the specter of, well, this could be a detriment to environmental quality. You know, we can't have people living outdoors because then there's sanitation problems. So that's where I came on board. I got in touch with Larry Templeton, and I said, Larry, you know, you really need an environmental consultant to help you understand, you know, to help you understand how the state water code works and how you can live here by the side of the river or wherever it is you end up living and not have an impact on water quality. So we wrote up a contract, and Larry signed me on for $1, and that was my way of just kind of making it official because, again, since I'm an agent of the state over the hill, I need to very carefully, you know, not represent anybody that I'm here on behalf of the state or, you know, when I represent my clients. It's a very different role. Okay, so my approach was to write a pollution prevention plan for Camp Paradise. And there's two, and this, I'm sorry, this pollution prevention plan I presented to City Council on July 10th. It was, you know, in the public forum. I just wanted to actually lodge that in the public record and let, you know, officially let the public know that Camp Paradise had prepared and implemented a pollution prevention plan. It's got findings and it's got provisions. It's very consistent with what's required in the State Administrative Procedures Manual for filing a report of waste discharge. The findings really just kind of state the nature and intent of water quality problems in the San Lorenzo River, including all the causes, part of which is people living outdoors. But there's a lot of other causes for water quality impairment as well. And the provisions just simply say, okay, Camp Paradise agrees to, you know, protect, you know, the river due to erosion from, you know, of soils and sediments, to implement, you know, measures necessary to protect sanitary conditions. And to that end, they just rent a camping toilet that's good for 500 flushes, and they haul it out. There's probably better things that could be done. They could rent a porta potty, but again, that requires some cooperation with the city. This is something I would like to help them negotiate. And the bottom line was, and they agreed to consult with city staff on any matters and say, hey, is there anything else we need to be doing? Now, this was really important because my understanding, you know, I recognized that the city was going down this path where they were going to start waving around that specter of, well, you know, we'd like to let you stay, but you can't because of this water quality issues. So, in fact, we did, you know, again, present this in a public record on July 10th, and then the next day I sent copies along with this cover letter to the mayor and all council members and said, you know, if there's anything your staff need, you need to call me. As you most of you know, on, I guess, a week ago, Larry Templeton and the members of Camp Paradise got sleeping ban tickets issued, and Larry Templeton was also slapped with 4 environmental charges, 2 of which come out of state fish and game code. And, you know, we went and looked up Section 1603 of the State Fish and Game Code, which says you can't modify a riparian channel. And again, it's an important piece of the code, but if you go in there and you read it, Section 1603, like all pieces of the state code that deal with environmental issues, is very procedurally oriented. There's a lot of burden on city staff or whoever is trying to enforce it to first, you know, request and compel that certain actions be taken to say, well, we don't like this goldfish pond. We think that this should be removed, and the way you have to remove it is by moving the soil over here and revegetating. And they did none of that. They kind of came in and were straight with enforcement. So, you know, the short-term goal is actually to kind of slow down the city staff a little bit and say, no, wait a minute, let's talk this through. The longer-term goal, and the more important part here, is actually to get through this public process by, you know, saying, hey, no, we all have to pay attention to administrative procedures, to get people to think about how we can take 2 apparent problems we have as a city and bring them together, you know, as a solution. We've got the problem that people are living outdoors, and we're uncomfortable with just saying live outdoors anywhere you want to, because then there are, you know, potential impacts in the environment and there's potential nuisance factor, and, you know, in an orderly, you know, city, we don't want that. And at the same time, we're uncomfortable with being inhumane and writing tickets that willy-nilly that say, just get out. That doesn't work either. We need to find a way that we can deal with this housing crisis we have in Santa Cruz County and, you know, deal with the fact that people are living outdoors and use that as a human resource rather than throwing that human resource away. What we have here is essentially a de facto civilian conservation corps, and you know, Tom Shaver, I think, is going to tell you a little bit more about an idea he had about how to actually move that forward and get the city's buy-off on that without forcing them to grapple with changing the whole municipal code. And Robert, I know you're not going to like the sound of that, but at the same time, there's a way of actually, you know, I think Tom Shaver's idea of actually leasing that land from the city as an interim solution is a good one. Now, the thing to be aware of is that
There is going to be some discomfort with any sort of acceptance of people living in the riparian zone, and I think that that's a legitimate environmental concern. And the way to address that is to say, okay, this is not the permanent solution. It may come out to be that they have to find a different place to locate. But a lease is just that. It's a temporary lease. And there's, you know, in the language of state water code and CEQA, you know, the way you say that is you need to, if you're going to make it a permanent situation, you have to have a full environmental impact assessment. And yet at the same time, there is a place to come up with a temporary, an interim solution. I guess I just want to close with just some, you know, some thoughts that about a way to go about this where we can get everybody on board. You know, Sarah and I were at Camp Paradise last Sunday and for their Sunday services. And Larry, as he led it off, you know, one of the really inspiring things he said was, well, you know, now that he's surrendered to the higher power, what he recognizes is that there is no such thing as bad guys. Everybody is an agent to him of the higher power. So he doesn't, you know, blame the police for going out and writing tickets, even, you know, the outrageous tickets that say, you know, hey, you've done environmental damage. And it was really, for me, it was inspiring to hear him say that, because when I heard that they wrote my clients these, you know, violations under Section 1603 of the Fish and Game Code, I thought my inner cowboy was saying, you bunch of yahoos, you've had your backs turned to this river for decades, and now you have the dare to go and write a ticket for modifying the riparian zone. You've got a roller coaster in the tidelands. But it was good to hear Larry say that, you know, that it's okay, they're all agents, because when you put it that way, it's like, well, yeah, okay, the police are doing a service, you know, by taking a hard line on enforcing the law, they're elevating the discussion, they provide us an opportunity to push back. And so when we talk to the city council, when we talk to the city staff, you know, we should present it that way. You know, thank you for bringing up Section 1603 of the Fish and Game Code. We appreciate it. You pointed out something very important here that is very meaningful to the city, because in about 2 years, the city is going to be under a municipal stormwater permit, and they're going to have to prepare a pollution prevention plan that looks every bit as good as this, and they're going to have to live by it. In fact, that's another point I want to interject here in the public process is, if the city does use its police powers to displace my clients, we as, you know, citizens still have the right to expect the city to maintain environmental quality in the region of Camp Paradise up to the standard it's been maintained so far. So, thanks for your time. I'm glad to take any questions. You know, my role in this, primarily, I am Camp Paradise's environmental consultant, so everything I'm saying is really on behalf of my client. You know, there is a bigger picture here. I am interested in elevating the discussion and getting people thinking about, you know, kind of long-term solutions. But
thank you.
Thank you.
Environmental consultant, now from their real estate agent. No, I don't know. What is it, Tom? What do you do?
You want me to talk?
Yeah.
My name is Tom Shaver, and for those of you who don't know, I was the Green Party county coordinator during the registration drive in the early 90s. I've been away and haven't been very involved lately, but I've been.
Welcome back, Tom.
Thanks. What I have been involved with lately is organizing the Community Housing Land Trust of Santa Cruz County, which is set up to buy or lease land and offer the housing on that land, or build housing and offer it for sale or rent to people at affordable prices in perpetuity. And so when I just moved over to the neighborhood where Camp Paradise is, and Carl invited me to go over there, and I was really impressed with what's going on there, and also hearing how the neighbors are looking favorably on the situation, and in fact saying yes in my backyard instead of no in my backyard, which is the normal way the homeless situation is considered. I got to thinking, you know, what role could the land trust play in this area, and to keep the benefits that are there, allow the camp to continue playing this service, performing the service that they're performing for the community and the city. And so I just got to thinking, what if the land trust, or for that matter any nonprofit, you know, we're a new organization and we're not quite sure whether we're really prepared to take this on, to be honest with you. But some nonprofit to lease that land and create, negotiate with the city the terms of that lease, and whatever lease payment or sort of stipulations that the city would like to have in terms of its prevention plan, maybe a density of campers, designated campsites, you know, whatever the city might want to say, this is, you know, within these parameters. And I think that the rules that are going on right now at Camp Paradise would easily fit in with whatever the city might do. That this nonprofit would also hold an insurance policy that would cover any mishaps that might happen in relation to operating this campground, and be the go-between between the city and the campground. So that it's not the city who's directly managing it, because they don't want a management nightmare. But what the attitude that I would expect the land trust to take on regarding the campers, that the campers are already managing their own campground, we just want to allow them to do that. They have their own leadership structure, but there would be some sort of relationship with the land trust to make that work. So I've been passing this idea around that the campers were just like, whoa, giving me hugs and everything when I came talked about this, and that whoever I talked to in the land trust board is really excited about this idea. I presented this a couple nights ago on community TV, and Mark Primack and Scott Kennedy were encouraged by this notion. It's Scott Kennedy was saying, you know, why doesn't a nonprofit stand up? And I stood up, you know. So, and I talked with Tim Fitzmaurice. He's worried about the fish and game regulations, but he's going to look into that. You know, whoever I talked to about this, like, let me help. So I wrote up my ideas for this, and this needs to get some more, get fleshed out some more. There's a meeting on Tuesday morning at 9, to which Mark Primack, Scott Kennedy, Scott Templeton, or Larry Templeton, Khalil, and a few other people are coming to think this through. So I don't know how the Green Party might want to regard this. I know there's a lot of energy here supporting the camp. This is going to be a challenging effort. And if nothing else, it will spark some thinking about, if not here, where and how. So any help that you can direct our way would be helpful. Thank you.
How courageous. By the way, in case people don't know, this is Sarah, Khalil's wife, and Sarah is a reporter with the Metro that has done these incredible stories about Camp Paradise, one after another, telling the community what's going on there.
There's some researching that I see could be done. Linda's working on researching the insurance angle. I think I've heard of other campgrounds, like in Portland. There's a camp somewhere that the city sanctions in some way. We need to know what's going on with that and what their rules are.
There's a big one in Marin City, I think.
Right. So there's an area just researching other campgrounds and what the agreements are. What are the lessons learned from the previous campground that was permitted in the 90s? Or whenever that was, potential funding sources. I've heard about the possibility of a campsite that the city owns, that people have been thinking could be a good campsite in the Poconet. Be nice to think about, you know, think about that.
Could I take a stab at the question?
Sure.
One sec, Khalil. How much time do we have? You need to make sure we get to the address. This is the halfway mark. It's 15 minutes. And are you looking at the resolution to be part of the
Yeah, definitely. And maybe with any other one.
Maybe we can come back.
I'd like to
can, make an arrangement so that if Larry and Elias are late afterwards, the duty doesn't come. This guy has been going 18 hours a day. He said he's going 21 hours a day. He's exaggerating. The neighbors appreciate Camp Paradise because that place was known as Heroin Alley before, and they it sounds unreasonable that they would pull out 24 tons of garbage. You had to go down there and see it and pull out beside the bushes to understand that. So a lot of people want to help and are interested, and we've got something going called the Friends of Camp Paradise, and it's sort of an umbrella list. And I'm going to read you the what is sort of the default charter of it, and if any of you are interested, contact later. And here's what we say. The Friends of Camp Paradise recognize that Camp Paradise is established an area that is, one, free of trash and garbage, two, free of drug dealing and intoxicated people, and three, a temporary safe haven for homeless people. It's the first. Friends of Camp Paradise encourages the City Council and the Santa Cruz community to allow the camp to remain in existence until, one, we can be sure that the area will remain free of garbage, drugs, and drinking and disorder, and two, provisions made for housing the people now living at Camp Paradise. Three, there is no official line for Friends of Camp Paradise. We act individually as members of Friends of Camp Paradise, or in groups as members of Friends of Camp Paradise. Friends of Camp Paradise communications and literature should not be considered valid unless their source is identified and means to contact that source is provided, because stuff is being put out under the names of Friends of Camp Paradise because a lot of people are friendly to Camp Paradise. And the fourth is that people taking stronger stands or having particular priorities are encouraged within Friends of Camp Paradise to form subgroups. So those are the four principles, and any of you interested in getting involved in Camp Paradise, and I'll put a few sheets of refer to that up here for later picking up. And Larry's not here. Was one of you guys that just wrote up this proposal?
Pardon?
You know, you guys just went over there.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll read the proposal.
This is a proposal first to be decided upon by the Green Party.
Resolution to be adopted by the Green Party of Santa Cruz County. We call upon the City Council of Santa Cruz and the Santa Cruz County Board of Supervisors to affirm their commitments to human rights by committing to the following principles and taking the necessary action in order to implement these principles. One, homeless people may legally reside in the city and county. What a concept. It doesn't say what a concept. The current laws of the city of Santa Cruz, known as the sleeping ban and the camping ban, are unjust and probably unconstitutional. The sleeping ban should be repealed and the camping ban altered so that homeless people can carry on necessary life-sustaining functions within Santa Cruz city and county. The current laws of the county of Santa Cruz that criminalize sleeping on public property and public roadways, parks, and beaches are likewise violations of human rights. Two, law officers must minimize the impact of laws on homeless people. During any period when Santa Cruz residents are penalized for being without homes, there is a conflict between the demands of social justice and the requirements of law enforcement. Given that law officers have considerable discretion in the enforcement of any law, and that discretion should always be exercised in the interest of justice, enforcement should be inflicted only in those few egregious cases where the public good clearly and immediately requires it. Three, assurance of minimum enforcement. If the second principle is not followed under the conditions described above, officials responsible for the failure should be replaced.
What does that mean?
You can say the chief of police or the city manager.
They should be replaced in general. They should be replaced. Or?
If they don't do this, what we're proposing is that this be adopted, and that if, for instance, the city council and the mayor will tell you that the city manager and the chief of police are beyond their control, but actually the city council, I'm told, has the ability to replace the city manager. And also the city council gives direction to the city manager, but if the city manager is not doing the council and therefore the people's bidding, the city manager can be replaced, and the city manager in turn can replace the chief of police. So we're saying
enough of a bad excuse. Pardon? Yeah. Basically, do it. Action to be taken by the Green Party of Santa Cruz County. Commence a vigorous educational campaign to bring home to the Santa Cruz community the injustice of current laws affecting homeless people and the actual impact these laws are having. And I just want to say one thing, because I've only recently learned about the blanket ban. And I don't know to what extent this group, I think this group's consciousness is high, but I'm certain that most of the community does not really understand the implications of the blanket ban. It's just one piece. And it basically says that you cannot wrap a blanket around yourself between 11 o'clock and 8:30 in the morning.
Outside.
11 p.m. and 8:30 in the morning. So a shivering homeless person, child, woman, man, can't even legally keep warm. That's how bashing is we've gotten. And that one really blows me away. I realized this morning that I live in this community, that's one of my laws too. And it's a bit, it makes me a bit of a Nazi. And that's just one piece. Also, they can't sleep. So they're subject to being rousted by the police from 11 at night to 8:30 in the morning. It's illegal for them to sleep. And all this is by way of trying to get them out of town. Don't want them in the jails, because then we have to feed them and take care of them. They really don't. They just want them gone. We want them gone. Well, if you're controlled. So this is about changing and sending a strong message. Carl spent a lot of time writing this, and Nancy, who isn't here, and Ray came up with some of this language. Joel also a lot.
He's guilty.
And Robert, too. He's been working for a long, long time.
Can we ask questions?
We're now in a discussion, we're now in a discussion of this resolution with an eye to approving it. So,
I'm hearing two different approaches here. One approach is let's try to work with the city council, the mayor, and this one is real more straw mind. And I'm wondering if those two could cause conflicts in accomplishing something. Because I actually support that idea in the long run, but it's like, how do we work this out so that we can negotiate with them and try to work with them and not try to make them the enemy, and at the same time make them accountable? I just feel like I don't want to have us get into this, and then the next thing we're like shooting ourselves in the foot, because to them, that would be really hostile. And I'm concerned about that, because I want this to work, but it's like I don't see how it could if there's these two different opposing positions that are almost dialectically opposing each other.
Thanks for sharing. When's this next week, according to the schedule, we have 5 more minutes.
So I'll try to talk fast. In response to what someone was saying, and looking at number two in this proposal we're asking for support, this law proposal talks about how homeless people are treated because of this obscene and illogical law across the board. And it doesn't refer particularly to Camp Paradise. And I guess it would take a long discussion, but I've already had dozens of this, so I'd like to just say, outside of this meeting, that's a worthwhile discussion for all of us to jump in and catch up on. I don't think that if, as a party, we pass this, it's going to impede a negotiating process specific to Camp Paradise, just because the city's already in over their heads. That's enough for it. They have to do something. And also because in the work of the homeless issues working group, we've already talked to the mayor in particular, who's registered green, who's asking for more support, and this would meet that need, at least pertaining to these illegal laws, which is part of what I want to say even before you spoke on it. I see this as something that some council members would welcome. It would give them a handle on something that they're getting a lot of sort of casual calls about anyway. And I also see it as because of issues of morality, life and death, humanity. I've gotten to do this kind of thing. Even if there were somebody on the council or meeting at the top of the bureaucratic community that was dumb enough to take it personal, we could deal with that very easily. I went on one and found that I could do that.
Okay, I have Jeff and Carl.
Just two things. One is the spirit of it sounds right on. Well, I guess I'm not sure it addresses Camp Paradise specifically, though. I suppose it could be construed in that way. I mean, I certainly support the spirit of it. The third item, though, seems to me to be sort of an empty concept. I mean, we're just saying they should be. They obviously won't be unless they meet the procedures. I mean, it's kind of a... I find the third one to be not really necessary to still endorse the spirit of the resolution. That's more important.
I'd like to reply to some of the points made. So the situation here is we have a general homeless problem. We have this specific Camp Paradise. The Green Party is not taking a position in this thing on Camp Paradise. We have these people who are working for Camp Paradise. Camp Paradise is a very special situation. These people are doing something that's quite remarkable, and they're going to get a response because of that. They're drug-free, they're alcohol-free, they're cleaning up the environment, they're getting people, etc. And a very positive image. So it's very possible that they will get a favorable resolution to their situation. People are not so immediate to rally to the interests of some of the other people who do not meet the same standards. And so that's what this is directed at. So we're calling on the Green Party to go with this resolution, which you say is strong and confrontational, but we need it. We need, actually, some of us feel we need a lot more. Whereas the Camp Paradise action is being handled by all sorts of people. And any of the Green Party people that want to get on board, it's fine. We're not asking the Green Party itself to do that. With respect to that third part, what we have heard repeatedly is we can't do anything about it. And what we're saying is, if they don't do something about it, here's what they can do. They can replace those people. In other words, they're saying, we can't do anything about the people that are going out there and doing this to the homeless people.
So, yeah. But yeah, it seems like the